Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the world premiere of Ralph Lemon's Geography Trilogy Part 3, Come Home Charlie Patton, the artistry of sitarist Ravi Shankar and clarinetist Jose French Ballester, and the jazz of Conjunto during the month of September. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining me today. In this portion of the program, we take a look at the conflicting views of human embryo research. Biologist Jane Mayenschein is our guest. She is the author of Whose View of Life? Embryos, Cloning, and Stem Cells. Let me share with you a description of the book. This comes from the book's jacket. Saving lives versus taking lives. The public regards human embryo research in these stark terms as a battleground of extremes, a war between science and ethics. Precisely that simplistic dichotomy, propagated by vociferous opponents of abortion and proponents of medical research, is what Jane Mayenschein seeks to counter with this book, Whose View of Life brings the current debates into sharper focus by examining developments in stem cell research, cloning, and embryology in historical and philosophical context, and by exploring the legal, social, and ethical issues at the heart of what has become a political controversy. That from the book jacket of Whose View of Life? Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Jane Mayenschein. Join the discussion with the telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Jane Mayenschein, is Regents Professor of Biology and Society and Director of the Center for Biology and Society at Arizona State University. Her book, Whose View of Life, is published by Harvard University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Mayenschein, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Sure, thank you.
Sure. You point out that human embryo research raises problems because it seems at its core, to be quoting you here now, to be about defining and defending life. Would you talk with us here at the outset about the various approaches, the interpretations you call them, about when a life becomes a meaningful life worthy of protection?
Well, that's quite a big set of questions that you just asked there, which I think is part of what this whole set of issues is about. Mm-hmm. So there are questions about what we mean by life. There are questions about what we mean by embryos. And there are questions about the extent to which embryos are alive, which they clearly are in some sense, or the extent to which they're really a life in the same sense that we usually use for applying to a human being. So we have to untangle all of those things. What my study tries to do is place this discussion in historical context. And one thing that we see is that these are not new issues that just popped up yesterday. They're issues that we've been thinking about for a long time. So the question what an embryo is and its status as a person or not has been something we've been discussing for centuries in different ways. And also what we see is historically is that it's really only recently that we have such stark debates about about what we take as life and as something worth preserving. So we see the way that the discussions have changed, the assumptions have changed through time. Okay, so an embryo is something that is alive. It is the product of usually egg cell and a sperm cell coming together, starting to divide. In humans, which is what most of us care about, we don't care as much about mice, though maybe we should. We can learn a lot from them. But in humans, we have that fertilization moment, and an embryo is defined as from that moment to the eight-week stage, at which point we define what we have as a fetus, because that's the first point at which we have all of the organ systems in place. The fetus then persists until we have birth, and then we have a baby, and then we have eventually a grown-up for most of us, not quite all of us maybe, but and then from there. So that embryo is the moment from the egg and sperm coming together to the eight-week stage. It is alive. It is a life in a sense, but for biologists, it has quite a different status than the fetus with all of its separate, all of its parts in place, or the live-born baby. So where do you want to go from there?
Well, let's talk about the debate today. You mentioned a moment ago that these things have been things that we've, as human beings, been grappling with for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But the debate today is set in such stark terms.
Yep.
How come?
That's a great question, and it's a frustrating thing to talk about in a way. Yes, we have very polarized terms, and a simplistic answer to why is that, in fact, one, we know more and can do more now, so the stakes are higher, but also we have abortion politics, which is highly, you know, made everything kind of highly intensified over what it was before. And in a sense, the human embryo is visible. So from 1978 on, the human embryo is something that has existed not only in the mother, but also in the petri dish in the laboratory. And so it's really 1978 is a point where there's a difference. Before that, all we had was the embryo inside the mother, where we couldn't see it, we don't really know what's going on, and we can't control it in any way. After 1978, fertility clinics and fertility specialists have been able to pull that egg out of the mother, fertilize it, and have an embryo in a dish. And so that embryo in the dish has started to be something that we think about and that we have highly polarized views about, because some people say absolutely they are certain that the minute the egg is fertilized and you have an embryo in the dish, it is a life, it is a human, it deserves protections just like any of the rest of us. So some people say that at one extreme, and some people at another extreme say, no, it's just a bunch of cells, that's all it is, it's nothing special and deserves no protection. So we set up a dichotomous, if you will, or polarized debate at that point that then gets, in the context of abortion politics, intensified.
Hmm. Why 1978? That's when we have Louise Joy Brown
exactly
arrive on the scene. But before that, we had Roe.
Yes. So before that, so the 1970s was a really active time in many ways. The 1970s, sort of mid-70s, is a time when recombinant DNA work, for those of us who are old enough to have been alive then and remember those debates, recombinant DNA work first came along, and people started splicing genes into tomatoes and strawberries and other things, and that got people a little nervous about what those crazy scientists are trying to do. And that's led to debates about genetically modified organisms more generally. So we have that going on in the context. We have Roe v. Wade decision that clearly focuses attention on abortion, and that decision, that Supreme Court decision, said we are not going to decide what's viable or when a life begins, but we are going to rule in favor of a woman's right to make decisions about her own body. So that really was a decision about embryos that are in the mom, embryos and fetuses primarily, It's the later stages that we're most concerned about, that then in the Roe case we're most concerned about. So those were in the mom. Roe doesn't say anything about what's in the dish, so to speak. But in 1970s also there was legislation about protecting human subjects, and all of that language is about humans that are born or fetuses, but nothing about embryos. So there's a context in the 70s in which many things are swirling around, coming together, and many questions are raised without answers being given. So he set up a political context in which people want and need answers because actions need to be made, and we need to decide which actions we think are legal and right.
Yeah. Writing about Louise Joy Brown, the world's first so-called test tube baby, her birth in 1978, you say we were bioethical innocents at the time.
Yes.
What should we know about the history of the field of bioethics?
Well, it is the case that we have a field of bioethics, not that we had nothing before, but before the last couple of decades, bioethics mainly meant clinical ethics, clinical medical ethics, so theologians often or philosophers working in clinics, in hospitals, alongside physicians, trying to figure out what was right. And that field really arose out of concerns from the Nuremberg trials following World War II, where there was concern that the Nazis had not treated humans with respect. And so defining what we mean by respect, and then how that carries to issues about organ transplantation, rights to die, all of those sorts of clinical issues really were dominating the discussion of bioethics. What happened after we have in vitro fertilization is that new questions come along, and then with the Human Genome Project in the 1980s, the National Institutes of Health set aside funding specifically for what they call the ELSI program, the Ethical, Legal, and Social Implications program, specifically looking at genomics and things related to genetics and genetic modification. So that put a lot of emphasis on the ethical, legal, social issues related to development of science. So not just in genetics, people started thinking beyond genetics as well. So we had a set of questions arising out of the 1970s, especially by the 1980s, we get a context in which there are bioethicists being trained because of ELSI money, because of a rise of graduate programs supported by ELSI money. So there's just a lot more sensitivity to bioethical issues that go beyond the old theologian philosopher world of bioethics. So more people trying to connect with the biological sciences. And that trend still continues. That has a bit of a problem in that at times we then set up these bioethicists as if they were the experts who are then supposed to decide what's morally good. And I think that there are probably a lot of people who would not agree with all of the academic bioethicists.
Yeah. Well, you say in the end, citizens must learn something of the language of science, and scientists must become more politically literate. We must become more scientifically literate. They must become more politically literate. Maybe talk with us about that idea.
I think that's really important, that so often there's this arrogance in the scientific community saying, oh, those stupid people in the public, they don't know anything. We need to educate them. We are the ones who know, and we will convey our knowledge to them. And we do need some of that because scientists are experts and they do know the technical work. So they do need to be better at conveying their knowledge. But they also need to be very clear, we need to be very clear that there's a society in which we exist and that society has real interests and needs, and that there are a lot of really smart people and citizens who are well-intentioned. I'm sure the listeners of your program are well-intentioned, smart people who want to know. And so scientists need to learn to communicate and not just talk at people. And they need also to understand the world and the complex world in which they're operating. They need to understand why it is that people might think what they're doing isn't the greatest thing since sliced bread or whatever.
Yeah. And also we need to have a better grip on, you know, what is the science and what it tells us and what it does not tell us.
Exactly. There's so much misinformation and in some cases, purposeful misinformation because political interest will spin a story in a certain way. But it's so difficult at times to get information. So what is really possible? What is really going on with stem cell research? We hear on the Democratic Convention, we hear Ronald Reagan saying, hey, let's do stem cell research. It can solve all these problems. And then we hear on the Republican Convention, we hear Michael Reagan saying, no, it's important to protect embryos and stem cell research isn't really that important. And so for a citizen to understand what the controversy is about, you really need to understand not just sort of which political people are on which side, but what is possible with the science, what really is realistic with the science, as well as what do we think morally. We need to untangle what our moral views are, as well as our political views. We need to understand why somebody conservative, self-proclaimed conservative pro-life advocate like Orrin Hatch can say, I believe that we have to do stem cell research. There's a moral imperative to do it because of the potential good. We need to understand why such a man can say that and is not, embracing some, crazy inconsistency, but he's thought it through and he has reasons for that. So we need to understand the science, the politics, and the ethics, as well as everything else while we're at it.
Yeah, so suddenly into focus come not only black and white, but a lot of grays.
Exactly. And that's, I think, my main point, and maybe it's because I was brought up in a certain way to be tolerant, and maybe that's a mistake, but my main point throughout discussions of embryo research and other things related to biology and society issues is that can't we please try to avoid polarizing the issues? I mean, we do that politically so often, and there's reason that we do it politically. We want to make there be clear differences of choice. But in a lot of these situations with science, it shouldn't be black and white, but it should be gray. It shouldn't be that it's science versus morality, but it's how do we negotiate a wise science and wise morality that all works together. So how do we avoid extremes and work together where I believe that most people really are?
Mm. You mentioned Senator Orrin Hatch. Also, Senator Trent Lott supports expanding stem cell research. Mm-hmm. How were these anti-abortion, pro-life senators persuaded to support federal funding for stem cell research? What can you tell us about how they came to their point of view?
I think that it's really, really instructive to look at Orrin Hatch's case, where he was very thoughtful about, and he tries to understand what's going on with other scientific issues as well. I worked with our congressman for 2 years, and that was on the House side rather than Senate side. But we knew which senators were trying to learn and were sending their staff to meetings to try to learn. And he clearly was somebody who was open-minded and trying to learn, but was very much as we've said, the pro-life side of things. He says that he changed his mind when first some elderly constituents came in and said, we see promise for therapies for us, and we do not want the door foreclosed on that promise. We know it might not work. We know this research may not lead to therapies that will help us personally, but we think that the opportunity should be there. And then he talks about how, in fact, some young people came to him, and he was persuaded, especially, he said, and it was compelling to hear an 11-year-old and then a 13-year-old talk to him. These were young women who had juvenile diabetes, which is one of the areas that people think that stem cell research is most likely to pay off with therapies because of some research with mice and other animals that are promising. And so these young women said, I am a diabetic. My best hope, I'm young, 11, 13. My best hope of having a good life is to have some sort of therapy. I believe that we should try every kind of research that, in fact, might bring that sort of therapy to me. And one of those young women, the 13-year-old, said, I find it hard to believe that senators can compare those cells that are in a dish, that are in the Petri dish in the fertility clinic, can compare those cells to me. I find it hard to believe that those cells have the dreams that I have and can care and can hurt the way I can hurt. You know, this is about me, a person already born. I have a different status than those cells in the dish. I mean, she didn't quite put it that articulately, but basically, you know, it's an articulate, passionate claim that, you know, the comparing her to the cells in the dish was a mistake. And Hatch said he understood that, and he therefore did not see why we should not use those embryos that are frozen away in fertility clinics, why we should not use those that are going to be thrown away anyway, in many cases, we should not use those to do research that might help somebody. It might not, but it will teach us something, and it might. And the fact that it might help real people is something that we should do.
Hmm. And another decision that was made, let's talk about President George W. Bush and his order issued in August of 2001 on stem cell research. What can you tell us about how he reached that decision, the decision to limit federally funded research to 74 stem cell lines already in existence?
Which the number was contested, so 74 at most, and down to what NIH says is probably 11 of those lines that still exist and are useful, and many of those in private hands. So, right, on August 9th, 2001, the president made a decision, and we could ask, why did he make a decision? Mm-hmm. Why was he having a view about this? Well, it's because there had been an executive order by President Bill Clinton saying that the National Institutes of Health could fund some stem cell research and some embryo research. So an executive order stood. President Bush had campaigned saying that he would overturn that order and that he would be against, and he would come out against any embryo research. What Bush did on that 2000 day, which is before September 11th, 2001, so it might have been different thinking or not have thought about this as an important issue afterwards. But what he did in August was to say that we could use the lines that were already in existence. He was freezing at that moment against the use of federal funding to produce any more stem cell lines. But those lines already existed. Those embryos didn't exist anymore. We weren't going to be killing, as he put it, or destroying, as he also put it, any embryos anymore to use those lines. So let's use those lines of research, or those stem cell lines, and see what research can tell us using those lines. It was a very nuanced interpretation or decision on his part. He said he appealed to prayer. He talks about talking to theologians, talking to bioethicists, and appealing to prayer to decide this issue. He does not talk about appealing to scientists particularly, though it is clear that his aides, Karen Hughes in particular, relied on the National Institutes of Health report and their scientific summary of what looked possible in making this decision. So I made a decision that, in a way, pleased no one. I think it's a nuanced decision and a sensible one, given his particular views. He allowed some research to go forward, not nearly as much as scientists would have liked, or as many of the potential, the sufferers who potentially could benefit would have liked, but more than the so-called hard right that really wanted to oppose any kind of research would have allowed. So it was an interesting and difficult decision, clearly on his part. He also left open that we could revisit this decision in future, and it seems from the current presidential debates that we probably will be revisiting this in the next congressional cycle.
Hmm. Biologist Jane Mayenschein is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Whose View of Life? Embryos, Cloning, and Stem Cells. She is Regents Professor of Biology and Society and Director of the Center for Biology and Society at Arizona State University. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments for our guest. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one. Let's talk with this caller in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi. I'm surprised there are not more calls. I'm getting a frog in my throat, so I might fail. But I wanted to the point you were just talking about, that the private industry and bioscience are going ahead with this, and I don't know if anybody's tracking that, but one thing that this does is it ensures that this research is done in private hands, and I think that's a problem in that there's not as much peer review, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it actually, you wouldn't could make the argument that it would be better if more of it was done in public institutions, though that actually seems to be breaking down somewhat too, but that's another show. What prompted me to call is your history in the beginning, and there's a book that was published by U of I Press that I just think should have more of an impact, and it's A Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion. And the first part of the book, the last part of the book, is about Catholicism, and the first part of the book is quite good about history and the history of the Church, and the idea that it was sort of 17th century scientism that established this idea that life began at conception, that historically Aquinas and many other Catholic writers talked about the quickening, and that people say that this is why there is no ceremony for stillborn infants and things like that, that it wasn't believed, and it was actually the early days of science that began to believe that, you know, there was a small beginning creature, homunculus, I guess it was called, and that this persuaded the scientists, maybe for other reasons too, but this was sort of the theoretical backdrop for them believing. It's a very, very stunning analysis, I think, and it's just not commented on much, it seems to me. I don't know if you might even be familiar with that, but it's just called A Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion. It gets into the antecedents to all these philosophical views. But I would like for you to also talk about what I seems to be sort of a diversionary thing is the preoccupation with adult stem cells. Now, I'm not saying that the research isn't promising and shouldn't go ahead, but it really isn't the same thing. So basically people use it to kind of change the subject, it seems to me. And I just as a last thing, and I better go, is I think one can have a nuanced approach to this and say, I mean, I have very much hello in its role in bioengineering. I'm very skeptical. I think that needs very long longitudinal studies and surveys, and I'm very skeptical of corporate pushing of that. But at the same time, I would like for the this research to go ahead.
Okay, there's a number of really good issues there on the table, and thanks for the call, and get yourself a glass of water there. Where would you like to start?
Well, I'm not sure if somebody's allowed to have four such good points all in the same call, but let's touch first because I think it's simple but really important. The point about the Catholic Church, I think I do want to just reinforce that point, and I'm glad to know about the particular book, which I will go and read right away. So it was Pope Pius IX in 1869 who actually declared that life begins at conception for the Catholic Church, and that would be the standard at that point. And so before that time, there was much discussion and much openness in the Catholic Church, and so some people have suggested, in fact, that if one pope changed his mind, so to speak, or had a different revelation about this point, that another pope could have a different view and that the Catholic Church could change. I'm not Catholic and I don't have a view about that, but others may. At any rate, it's very important to look at the history of Catholicism, Judaism, Muslim views, all of which until the 19th century really, but starting 17th through 19th century discussions, all of which said that life begins at quickening, which was usually taken to be 40 days or later, rather than before that. So those first 40 days are regarded as sort of the stuff is the fluids are starting to form, but you don't have a real person yet. So there is a long tradition of thinking in those terms. To pick up some of the other points, I think, you know, the last point that, yes, a nuanced approach makes sense, that we might say we want to allow some research to go forward, but not all research and not without regulation or oversight. That wasn't exactly the point the caller made, but I think it's implicit in what he said. I think that's absolutely right. I actually would argue for supporting research, but carefully regulated with careful oversight of that research and with oversight not just assigned to a group of scientists but to some sort of citizen and science board. And we need to think more about how to do that kind of thing. So a nuanced approach is good. A nuanced approach might very well say, yes, we should pursue work with adult stem cells as well as embryonic stem cells. They're not the same thing, and we might learn different things from both. Adult stem cells are stem cells taken from adults. They, therefore, are not involving disruption of the embryo. And the problems with adult stem cells is they're hard to find, and scientists haven't figured out how to get them to do a lot of tricks. So they're useful for some things, but not everything. We're not going to learn everything from adult stem cells, but of course we should continue research and learn as much as we can. So those are three of the points. The fourth point, or the first that he made, is really an important one for people to understand. Stem cell research, embryo research, can in the United States go forward with private funding. There are no federal laws. There are very few state laws. Some states are pursuing those now, but there are no federal laws prohibiting embryo research in the United States. The only federal legislation says that we restrict the use of federal funds for certain kinds of research. So private companies can go ahead with research. They are doing so. Harvard University is doing work in developing stem cell lines that they are sharing widely with others. The Stanford group is doing the same thing. Some companies behind closed doors are pursuing research, and it is precisely that, behind closed doors, proprietary research owned by individual companies, not in the public interest, not in the public ownership, not for the public good necessarily, not to say that private companies are always bad, but just that there's a decision that will leave them private, patentable, owned by individuals rather than by the public. And that's a decision that we have made by not making any other decision, in effect. Other countries are, in fact, doing this differently. The United Nations will be talking about embryo research over the next years and may make different decisions as well. But in the U.S., we've pushed it to the private domain.
Okay, very good. Lots of interesting issues there. Again, thanks to the
caller. Yeah, that
was
a great call. Thank you.
And let me invite others to join us. We've got about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. We're talking this afternoon about human embryo research. Our guest is Jean Mayenschein, and you can join us this afternoon with questions 333-9455, 800-222-9455. I want to raise a couple of names here and have you talk about Anthony Comstock and Margaret Sanger and what leads us to a shift in attitude? How do we go from one point of view to another?
Well, we would have to have a lot of discussion about many things in American history here to get at that. And I don't pretend to understand what makes the American public think what it thinks or have the laws that it has. But at the end of the 19th century, there were the Comstock laws. There was a strong sense that we humans don't talk in polite company, or for that matter any other company, about reproduction. We don't talk about sex. We don't talk about any of those sorts of things, and we certainly don't try to do anything about it. So contraception, attempts to the interest of families to have some kind of family control, family planning, was largely done behind closed doors in the privacy of one's bedroom or church or whatever, and not in public. And at the end of the 19th century and into the early part of the 20th century, there were reformers who said that's wrong, and that's not the way we should conduct society. So there's a change in what we value, and that, in fact, we should help people have information. We should not force anybody to be sterilized or to fail to have children. In the early part of the 20th century was the idea. We should not require anybody to have contraception or whatever, but we should enable it. We should allow it. We should help. Now, there was a eugenics movement that, in fact, did end up arguing for sterilization in the 1920s of a few people, the so-called feeble-minded and criminals and others, and that's another issue that we'll set aside. That would be another program. Mm. But the idea of contraception, family planning, letting families decide how many children they want to have, was really something that Margaret Sanger and a few other leading reformers took up and said, we want to teach women and teach families about birth control and about how they can control their lives, their family lives, to make better quality families. This was highly controversial. Margaret Sanger was arrested. Other people trying to bring birth control information in the early 20th century were arrested, were put in jail for doing so. And then fairly quickly, after World War I, there was a change of attitude. World War I really shocked people into saying, whoa, wait, what are we doing? Who are we? And moved us toward a more modern thinking, and then thereafter a number of historical social movements sort of began to change society, so that really by not fully until the 1940s and 50s, but by the middle of the 20th century, the idea of birth control as being information and opportunity for people to choose if they want to and not choose if they don't want to, but individually to choose, that sort of liberal individual choice model became accepted. So a lot of factors mm-hmm. coming together to make people move toward that, the idea of civil rights and individual choice.
Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Champaign. Line one, go ahead.
Hello. I heard, I came in a little bit late on your talk here, and I did hear you talk about adult stem cells. My question is, what about research that's being done on, is it umbilical cords or birth blood or things like that? Is that worth going into, or what is the value of researching that? And I was kind of hoping that would take the place of embryonic, but I have no idea, no understanding of the science of it. So I wish you'd explain that to me. Thank you.
Okay, great question. Yeah, there is research going on, and as research goes on, we learn more and more. And so our assumptions right now are the best science of the moment may change tomorrow. We may be able to learn more. But what happens is, So just a quick science lesson. I wish I had a blackboard here. I'm a teacher at heart. Yeah, I want to draw pictures for you. So imagine that you have an egg. It gets fertilized by a sperm. The one cell, which the egg is, divides into two cells, four cells, eight cells, keeps dividing into more and more cells. In those earliest stages and up to what's called the blastocyst stage, you can buy a book or go to the NIH website and see pictures of this, but up to that point, you have a lot of cells that each of those cells has a lot of potential, and it's not specialized yet. It's not yet a blood cell or a nerve cell or whatever, but it has a lot of potential, and it's those cells with all that potential that seem to have the most promise for stem cell therapies. That's why embryonic stem cells, where you have a lot of these cells together, they're easy to get out, a whole bunch of them together, and they all have these broad capacities. That's why they're so attractive. As you go along in development, So by the time you have a fetus, you have the baby, you have the umbilical cord, you're going along there, specialization, every step along the way. By that point, you still have some of those early stage cells circulating in the umbilical cord and in the placenta a bit, and interchanged with the mother a little bit. So you have some of those cells there, but they're now mixed with more specialized ones. They're a little harder to get out, but we can still find some of those embryonic type cells. Other cells are starting to become more specialized. As we go along into the adult, again, there are a few of those embryonic type unspecialized cells circulating around in each of us, but only a few. They're hard to find. Where are they? We don't have a little stem cell detector machine to find them. So it's very much more difficult to find them. And the other cells that have capacity to be useful for therapies are more specialized and therefore not useful for as many things. So we're cutting off opportunity. They're all useful. We should do more research. We should understand the capacities of all of them. We know very little yet about them, but we should continue the research. But we should know that the more specialized and the later stages we become, the more opportunities are restricted, as far as we know now.
Okay, another good question. We're running down here on the last couple minutes we can spend together today. Maybe we can take up these topics again at some point in the future. Our first caller mentioned bioengineering, and he kind of let us know that he's concerned about it, and I think that's an interesting question here to end with. Our intuition, how we feel, kind of how we, our view of the world, our gut. You know, what our gut tells us, like slow down or this is wrong. What role does intuition play in how we think about these issues? Should it play a role?
And since you've looked at my book, you know that I think we should be very nervous about relying on intuition. and yet our gut should tell us something.
Right.
So Leon Cass is currently called by me the bioethicist in chief. That's not his official title, but he's the head of the bioethics committee that President Bush appeals to. And he has what he calls the wisdom of repugnance, which is pure intuitionism. We should start with our intuitions, and we should see what we feel in our gut, and we should go from there. And I think that's really bad. That's a way to start and get some information. But as the lady who just called said, she didn't know a lot about adult stem cells. She wished that would be helpful, but she needs to know more. So our intuition might say, I want to go use adult stem cells only. But if you don't know more, your intuition isn't going to help you. Or I'm queasy about bioengineering. I don't think we should try to play God. That's a reasonable response, but it doesn't mean that leads you to saying, let's don't do any research. That might lead you to saying, okay, I want this research to be out in the open, in the public, and regulated by somebody and reported on so we know what's being done, and so we can negotiate where we want to stop, what research we want to do and what research we don't want to do. So it's not just a gut instinct with no knowledge in a vacuum, but it's an intuition informed by information.
Okay.
And an intelligent intuition, if you will.
Yeah, and where do we turn for that information? Who qualifies us as an expert?
That's the big question, isn't it? I think that we have to have a mixture of experts. We cannot simply say, oh, it's the theologian who's going to decide, or it's each individual, or it's the politicians, or it's the scientist. It has to be all of those people working with bioethicists, working with people, mediators, negotiators, people who are trained to say, here we have a lot of competing and contested polarized views. How do we bring those together and negotiate some kind of shared social understanding? How do we as a society figure out what we want to do? Not just that we vote for radical liberals 1 year and radical conservatives another year. How do we figure out how to negotiate some kind of stable middle ground that respects everybody's views. That sounds like a liberal talking. But yeah, how do we respect all the range of opinions, bring them together? How do we get some kind of meta experts, if you will, who can be sympathetic and understand the kinds of expertise and pull them together? That's our biggest question. I don't have an answer for how to do it, except that we have to start talking to each other. Scientists have to talk to the public has to express their concerns, people have to express their intuitions, we have to get them out there and talk about what makes sense, and we have to do it together.
Hmm. That's where we have to leave it. Professor Mayenschein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Biologist Jane Mayenschein has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Whose View of Life? Embryos, Cloning, and Stem Cells. The book is published by Harvard University Press. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Actually, Celeste, I have them today.
Okay.
And away we go. On a very light day with the volume not exceedingly high, the futures mixed for much of the day, particularly in that soybean pit and the corn. We see only the September contract in the red. It's been in the red for most of the day while others are in the green. Let's get to the specifics. September wheat, a high on the day of 309 and a quarter, a low of 306, settling 309 and a quarter, up 3.5. December, a high of 320 and three quarters, a low of 316, settling 319 and three quarters, up 2.5. March, a high of 330 and a quarter, a low of 326, settling 330, up 2.25. May, a high of 333 and three quarters, a low of 330, settling 333 and three quarters, up 4.25. In July wheat, a high of 336, a low of 333, settling 335.5, up 3 on the day. September corn, a high of 220, a low of 216 and 3 quarters, settling 217, down 2.25. December, a high of 228, a low of 225 and a quarter, settling 226 and 3 quarters, up a quarter. March, a high of 236.5, a low of 233 and 3 quarters, settling 235.5, up 1. May, a high of 242.5, a low of 240, settling 241 and 3 quarters, up 1. July, a high of 247.5, a low of 245, settling 247, up 1.25. December 05 corn, a high of 254 and 3 quarters, a low of 252 and 3 quarters, settling 254 and a quarter, up 1 on the day. September oats, a high of 143 and 3 quarters, a low of 140, settling 143 and 3 quarters, up 1 and 3 quarters. The December, a high of 147 and 3 quarters, a low of 145 and a quarter, settling 147.5, unchanged. September soybeans, a high of 589.5, a low of 580, settling 581.5, down 6.5. November, a high of 586, a low of 577.5, settling 583.5, unchanged. January, a high of 592.5, a low of 585, settling 590.5, down a half. March, a high of 599, a low of 592, settling 597 and a quarter, unchanged. May, a high of 605, a low of 598, settling 603, up 1.25. July, a high of 609, a low of 603, settling 607.5, down a half. September soybean meal, a high of 174.50, a low of 171, settling 171.90, down 150. October, a high of 169.80, a low of 166.50, settling 169.20, up 140. September soybean oil, a high of 24.95, a low of 24.35, settling 24.73, down 22. And the October contract, a high of 24.37, a low of 23.80, settling 24.09, down 25 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where it was a fairly significant up day in the feeder cattle, Celeste.
Okay, let's take a look at those prices. Yes, those September, October, and November contracts all up over a dollar today. September feeder cattle, 111.25 the high, 109.55 the low, 110.85 the settlement, that up 132.5. October, 108.65 the high, 106.60 the low, 108.07 and a half the settlement, that up 150. November. 107.90 the high, 105.97 and a half the low. The settlement 107.45, that up 147 and a half. October live cattle 83.40 the high, 82.40 the low, 82.90 the settlement, that up 52 and a half. December live cattle 86.90 the high, 85.80 the low, 86.37 and a half the settlement, that up 47 and a half. October lean hog 65.15 the high, 64.15 the low, 64.55 the settlement, that down 57 and a half. December 63.10 the high, 61.90 the low, 62 even the settlement, that down 127 and a half. February lean hogs 62.10 the high, 61.32 and a half the low, the settlement 61.42 and a half, that down 90. April lean hogs 60.75 the high, 60.20 the low, the final price 60.57 and a half, that down 27 and a half. And February bellies 96.60 the high, 94.85 the low, 96.05 the settlement, that up 30. The Dow is currently down 27 points at 10,316. The NASDAQ off 5 at 1854. The S&P 500 down 4 points at 1117.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Chris Burrows from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania writes, Dear Dr. Science, what is dirtier, the air we breathe or the sponge we wash our dishes with?
It depends on where you live, what you ate for dinner, and how often you change your dish sponge. Now, I change mine at least once a year. But then I use special irradiated sponges that are made from spun neodymium. So you might want to replace your less exotic sponge more often. You can filter the air you breathe by simply ingesting a packet of coffee filters and then burping them up so they firmly lodge in the bronchial tubes. Since there's no direct route from the esophagus to the bronchial tubes, well, gee, that might take some practice, but it's worth it if air quality matters to you and if you enjoy eating paper.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Dr. Science's new CD, Get Smart, is now available via mail and includes a Dr. Science screensaver for PC computers. For information, call 800-989-3825.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Henry Frain is our technical director today, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. It's 75 degrees in Urbana. Here's Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon in eastern and southern Indiana. Mostly cloudy with a few scattered showers in far southeastern Indiana. In northeastern and north-central Illinois, a mix of clouds and sunshine. Elsewhere, mostly sunny with highs ranging from around 70 near Lake Michigan.